Donald Trump has become the highest-ranking U.S. official charged with violating the Espionage Act. He's accused of taking documents that put American security at risk.
And it's pretty sensitive stuff. It's clearly is from his daily intelligence briefings, and he took it up to the residents.
Espionage Act 101. Also today, the U.S. has a new system for asylum appointments. Use the app.
La verdad, es una lotería.
But this woman says getting an appointment is like winning the lottery. Meantime, more people waiting in Mexico. Also in Hong Kong, officials try to erase an anthem of dissent. Unwittingly, they may have made it more popular.
This week it shot to the top of the iTunes charts in Hong Kong, so everybody in Hong Kong knows it whether they like it or not, and a lot of people like it.
I'm Marco Werman. It's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Former U.S. President Donald Trump made history today, again, the first time a former U.S. president appears in a courthouse facing federal charges, also the highest-ranking U.S. official to ever face criminal charges under the Espionage Act. Trump is accused of taking hundreds of documents from the White House, many of them highly classified. Some are related to the military and nuclear capabilities of the U.S. and other countries. Here to help us understand the stakes for U.S. national security is Tom Blanton. He directs the independent, non-governmental National Security Archive. One of the many laws President Trump is charged with violating, as I said, Tom, is the Espionage Act. When was the Espionage Act written into law, and what is it designed to do?
The Espionage Act dates back to World War I, 1917, and parts of it are so broad that generally I think historians and journalists are pretty skeptical when the government invokes the Espionage Act because it criminalizes basic possession of national defense information that can be just about anything, a map or a document. And we at the National Security Archive have published lots of documents we got officially declassified from one office that another office thinks are still classified. So generally, I'm pretty skeptical, but let me say, reading the full indictment that federal prosecutors brought, they listed 31 of the 337 documents that Mr. Trump apparently took, and with their classifications and code words, and it's pretty sensitive stuff from his daily intelligence briefings, and he took it up to the residents.
So the Espionage Act was designed to basically protect national security and national secrets. Is that right?
That's right. And it was at a time of increasing paranoia about foreigners. You had the prosecutions back then, World War I period, of folks like Eugene Debs, any dissidents, anybody who spoke out against the war and America's participation in it. So it's a statute that has some issues, has some problems. It kind of conflicts with the First Amendment of the Constitution, for example, on free expression.
So these documents that ended up in a storage room, in a bedroom, a ballroom, even a bathroom and a shower, how sensitive are they according to the indictment unsealed on Friday?
They're very sensitive, these documents, according to the indictment, because many of them are classified not just at the top secret level, but at the top secret code word, so above top secret. Even I think in 6 or 7, maybe 8 of the specific documents listed, the code word itself is still classified. They redacted it from the indictment itself. That's very striking. What it tells you is that these documents were part of very recent high-level intelligence based on sensitive sources and methods that were given to then-President Trump as part of his intelligence briefings, and he decided to keep them. He seems to have been treating these documents as if they were his personal property, like magazine covers that he kept for all those years.
As sensitive as these documents are, Tom, what would prosecutors have to prove to demonstrate that former President Trump violated the Espionage Act? I mean, bring in character witnesses from other countries?
No, what would it be? I think all the prosecutors have to do is show that he, quote, willfully retained these documents even after the government asked for them back. The way you avoid prosecution under the Espionage Act, if you've mistakenly or inadvertently taken classified information along with other papers, and that's what Vice President Mike Pence did, that's what former Vice President Joe Biden did. Those are the documents found in those guys' garages. But when the government had reason to come across them, or aides came across them, the government asked for them back. Pence and Biden gave them back right away. The indictment says Trump over and over refused to give back the documents, lied to his own lawyers about his boxes and his documents, and ordered this poor aide of his, Walt Nauta, former career Navy guy, to move boxes around to avoid anybody looking at them. And that includes moving them into that bathroom behind the shower curtain under the chandelier. That was one of the photographs in the indictment.
Tom, I don't know if you're hearing reactions from U.S. allies. I think of the Five Eyes, the group of intelligence sharing countries, which includes the U.S. If you were in their shoes, what would you be thinking today?
Well, I think the allies were pretty uncomfortable with President Trump while he was in office, and this is probably just going to heighten that feeling. There was a real disquiet about his carelessness with classified information even while he was serving as president. There's the famous incident where he gets a briefing on a Iranian missile test that blew up, and he tweets out the photograph, and the word in the media the next day or a couple of days were that the intelligence community was apoplectic about this because it put the Iranians on alert about what we could see in their space and nuclear capabilities. So I think there's a lot of discomfort out in the world. I think the real problem, though, with the indictment in terms of an international perspective, and this is a downside of the accountability, is that it probably, to a lot of foreigners, looks like a classic case that happens in their countries where an ex-president gets persecuted by his successors. And so there's a perception out there that I think was problematic for the United States. And that's just the unprecedented territory into which President Trump's behavior has really taken us.
One more thing, Tom. I think some people are really surprised to see that some of the most closely held U.S. secrets are held in file boxes. They're on paper. Aren't many of them shared digitally? I mean, are paper confidential records typical? What does that tell us if they're on paper?
Great question. Almost all the classified information in today's world, in today's United States military and security establishment, is digital. But then President Trump was famous for not being a digital guy. He doesn't use email. He got into tweeting, but he didn't take in his information digitally. President Obama, for example, got his daily intelligence briefing on an iPad. He was very comfortable with digital delivery of information. President Trump, I think the intelligence community quickly learned he liked his briefings on paper. And what seems to have happened is he took a number of those papers with him up to the residence. Now, the intelligence community is going to give the president what he wants when he wants it. So President Trump got his own paper.
Tom Blanton directs the independent non-governmental National Security Archive in Washington. Tom, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Oh, good luck, Marco. Great to hear your voice.
A month ago, the White House changed its policies for asylum seekers. It's now much harder for people who cross the U.S. southern border without authorization to remain in the U.S. That's left thousands of migrants stranded throughout Mexico as they try to get asylum appointments. Reporter Manuel Ureda has our next story from Mexico City, where shelters are struggling to accommodate the growing number of migrants waiting to hear from U.S. officials.
Casa Tochan is a shelter for migrants in Mexico City, where everyone has to do daily chores. Natalie Villarreal chops some onions and helps to serve breakfast to dozens of people. Then she sits down on some steps and takes out her phone. She's logging into a U.S. government app called CBP1 that schedules appointments at border posts for those who want to seek asylum in the United States. But getting an appointment is far from guaranteed. Only 1,000 spots are granted each day. This is like winning the lottery, she tells me as she taps on a blue button. I know some people who have been logging in for 2 months and haven't had any luck, while others try for a week and they get an appointment. A month ago, migrants from many countries could cross the U.S. border on foot and turn themselves into officials in order to start asylum proceedings. But that changed on May 12th. Now, it's much harder for people who cross the border without permission and present themselves to get asylum. If they're turned down, they're banned for 5 years from re-entering the United States. So migrants like Villarreal are playing it safe and they're attempting to apply for appointments online.
Las fronteras están llenas, saturadas.
The border area is full and it's dangerous, says Villarreal, who comes from Venezuela. So we're applying for the appointment in Mexico City, and we'll stay here until we can get it. So far, the new policies have led to a 40% reduction in illegal border crossings. But they've also put pressure on shelters in Mexico, even those that are far from the border. At Casa Tochan, there are 45 beds. But the shelter is now hosting 75 people and has rented a nearby apartment to accommodate women with children. Meanwhile, in the north of the city, 500 migrants are staying at the Cafemin shelter, though it's designed for just 80 people. Most sleep on the floor on gym mats that have been laid out on the shelter's basketball court. Mario Monroy is one of the shelter's coordinators.
It's very hard. The team here, it's maybe 22, 25 person, staff. And we don't have the time, don't have the energy. The food is very complicated.
He says the situation has been critical since October of last year, when the U.S. started to return thousands of Venezuelan migrants into Mexico.
El Instituto Nacional de Migración dejaba las personas.
Mexican officials were dropping off busloads of migrants outside our shelter after bringing them from the border, he explains. They were mistreated in U.S. detention centers and had no information about what to do next. Some migrants say they've given up on going to the U.S. due to the new policies. In the upscale neighborhood of Roma, you can find craft beer bars and trendy cafes that cater to digital nomads. But a camp was recently set up in a local park by hundreds of Haitians. They wanted to sleep near a government office that processes asylum requests for people who want to stay in Mexico. Leon Cifendi is a 31-year-old farm worker. He says he had been living in Chile for several years, but had to leave due to stricter immigration laws. If there's a chance to work in Mexico, I'm fine with staying here, he says. I just want to have a permit so that I can bring my family here. Soon after I speak with Fendi, the camp is dismantled by Mexico immigration officials, who shovel up everything the migrants can't take with them and put it in garbage trucks. Then, the migrants are taken to a government-run shelter that was recently opened on the city's outskirts, where it's impossible for them to find work. Human rights groups have urged the city government to open more practical shelters with better services. Gabriel Hernandez is the director of Casa Tochan.
El tiempo que estás en espera, que estés aprendiendo algo, que estés haciendo algo útil.
These people need something useful to do while they're here waiting for their paperwork to be resolved, she says. It's urgent for the local government to come up with a real policy for migrants. At Hernandez's place, the migrants are provided with support from a psychologist and with guidance on what steps they need to take to get work permits in Mexico. Still, many at the shelter say they will insist on going to the United States. And you can see them logging into the CBP app every morning, hoping to get one of the scarce border appointments. We need to be patient, says Venezuelan migrant Gabriel Alendo. We've been through a lot to give up on this now. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Mexico City.
Coming up later in the hour, charcoal is a critical source of energy across Africa. It's also bad for the local and global environment. So in northern Uganda, people have taken matters into their own hands to try and stop its production. Still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We've been covering the active volcano rumblings around the globe. Add to that list the Mayon volcano in the Philippines, about 200 miles southeast of Manila, more than 8,000 feet in elevation. It started spewing lava this weekend after weeks of increasing seismic activity. As Ashley Westerman reports from the Philippines, thousands of people who live nearby are relocating to safer ground.
At an evacuation center in Guino, Bataan, a small municipality at the foot of Mount Mayon, Jane Neo sits among thousands of others who have been displaced by their giant neighbor's recent seismic activity. She's been here since Thursday when she and her mother got the orders to evacuate. It's very sad, she tells me over the phone, because she had to leave her animals at home and there's no one to feed them. They only grabbed water and other essentials before getting in a car and driving 1 hour to the shelter.
Because our community is very large.
The situation is really hard, she says, because the community is very large. A video sent by an aid worker at the evacuation center shows rows and rows of tents lined up in a huge warehouse-type building. There's little space between them, and Neo says they're living four families to a tent. Still, she says they expect to be living there for the next 3 months. Around 15,000 people, mostly rural villagers, have been evacuated since the volcano entered alert level 3. That's level 3 out of 5, and it means that an eruption is certain, or a low-level eruption is already happening, according to Philippine volcanologists. Grex Logman, the local governor, told ABS-CBN over the weekend that he expects the alert level to soon be raised to 4.
Because of the new lava dome that has been spotted at the crater of Mayon.
When a new lava dome forms, that's another sign an eruption could be imminent. Mariton Bornas is with the Philippine Institute of Volcanology and Seismology. She says her team started seeing more activity than usual at Mayon last year. Now they're looking at several different scenarios for what could happen next.
So, for example, if the activity or the monitoring parameters stay this way, then we might be seeing a very short eruption, like in 2014.
But there could also be a long lava flow that goes on for months, or another scenario, things could get really explosive. They really don't know, Bornas says. Right now, there isn't much volcanic gas coming out of Mount Mayon, and experts are not sure why.
We've always had a lot of volcanic gas from the volcano when it's erupting, but now it's really not the case. And so we're really on guard as to what will happen next.
The last time the Mayon volcano erupted was in 2018, when it also displaced thousands of people. Photographer Chris Luminario remembers that well. She lives in Legazpi, the nearest big city to the volcano, and on Sunday took some photos from the roof of her home. Images of red-hot lava rolling down Mayon's perfectly cone-shaped slopes in the night.
You can actually see the whole crater because there was a lot of some clouds. You can see big rocks falling, that's glowing red rocks falling from the crater.
She grew up in the shadow of Mayon, the most active volcano in the Philippines.
It's actually very scary and very beautiful at the same time, because every time you woke up, you can see Mount Mayon right in your face.
But even as experts warn of an impending eruption, Luminario doesn't have any specific plans to prepare for it. Lava spewing from the mountain? That's just business as usual, she says. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman in Laguna, Philippines.
In Syria over the weekend, 22 American troops were injured in a helicopter accident. According to the statement from U.S. Central Command, the incident is under investigation, but no enemy fire was involved. At least 900 U.S. forces are currently stationed in Syria. Their mission dates back to 2015. We've asked Joshua Landis to help us understand how that mission has evolved. He is the Sandra Mackey Chair and Director of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Josh, let's start with a reminder of why U.S. troops were sent to Syria in the first place.
Well, there's really four reasons that they're there. The stated reason is the anti-ISIS campaign. If you recall, in 2014, ISIS became this very big power, and the United States decided it needed to destroy it, and it sent troops to Syria to do that. There are other reasons, though, as well. The last special envoy to Syria said that his job was to turn Syria into a quagmire for Russia and Iran. So it's there, in a sense, not to allow Russia and Iran to enjoy the fruits of their victory and to punish Assad. Three is to protect Syria's 2 million Kurds, who were instrumental in helping the United States destroy ISIS. And they sit in the northeast of the country where American troops are. And the fourth reason is to protect Israel, America's closest ally in the region. We have about 200 troops far from the ISIS area that are cutting the main highway between Damascus and Baghdad. And they are there in order to stop Iran from arming Hezbollah in Lebanon, which could attack Israel.
So that most public-facing reason for the U.S. to be in Syria was getting rid of ISIS. ISIS was defeated. So how big of a threat is the possibility they'd stage some sort of comeback or resurface as a similar radical group?
Well, there's still a presence in hit and run. They don't own any territory. Local military and policing could take care of it, but it is the legal reason that America can keep troops in Syria. Because of the war on terror, there is a UN resolution which allows the United States to fight that war, and it can be there for ISIS. But the other reasons, I think, have become as much, if not more, important.
I mean, the U.S., as you pointed out, is supporting Kurdish forces who are engaged in combat with Syria. Since U.S. forces have been there, have there been any direct fights between U.S. and Syrian troops?
Very little. Iranian-backed militias, particularly in Iraq, have shot at American troops with drones and attacked them. And just a few months ago, five were wounded and one was killed in an American base. And that was because of Iranian-backed Iraqi militia shooting. So America then killed a bunch of Syrians who are backed by Iran in retaliation. So those things have been going on, but mostly Syria and the United States have left each other alone in Syria. Of course, the Syrian regime in Damascus is very upset that America owns 30% of the country, is stopping its trade with Iraq, and has most of its oil and much of its good agricultural land, which it would like to use to rebuild the country, but which is going to supporting this Kurdish-led militia that America supports, the Syrian Democratic Forces, as they're called.
I mean, as parts of the Arab world are normalizing relations with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, is that going to change U.S. troop deployments there?
Yes. Eventually, the United States is going to pull its forces out of Syria. There's really no compelling reason that they remain there. But politically, it's going to be damaging to whichever United States president pulls them out. It's the same thing that happened in Afghanistan, where the can kept on being kicked down the road from one administration to the next because nobody wanted to take the grief. We can only have to think of the horrible things that have happened to the many Afghans that relied on the United States to turn their country into a liberal democracy, which failed. And the same thing has failed in Syria. And eventually, the United States is going to have to go home, and our allies there are going to have to find a way out.
Joshua Landis is the Sandra Mackey Chair and Director of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma in Norman. Josh, thanks very much for your time.
It's a pleasure being with you.
You're listening to The World. In much of the former Soviet Union, there's one brand of spring water that, at its source, has some special qualities.
Okay, let's taste it. Salty. It tastes a little bit like sulfur and hard-boiled eggs.
Why water from the Georgian spa town of Borjomi is persistently popular, even if it's an acquired taste. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A British woman was sentenced to 2 years in prison on Monday for taking abortion pills late in her pregnancy. Abortion is legal in Britain up to 24 weeks, up to 10 weeks if the pregnancy is terminated at home with pills. But this new ruling is based on an old law going back to the mid-1800s. And as the World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports, the news has outraged activists and lawmakers.
44-year-old Carla Foster has three children. Now she's facing a 28-month prison sentence for having an abortion.
It strikes me as very ironic that the solution to a mother of three feeling that she cannot have a fourth child is to separate that woman from her children and put her in prison.
Mara Clark runs a charity called SAFE, supporting abortions for everyone. She's based in London. In May of 2020, Carla Foster called up the office of the British Pregnancy Advisory Service. That was during the first COVID lockdown and no in-person appointments were taking place. She told the nurse practitioner at the charity that she was not yet 10 weeks pregnant, maybe around 7 weeks. The nurse agreed to send her abortion medication. It turned out that Foster was between 32 and 34 weeks pregnant. She took the pills, and a couple of days later, Foster gave birth to a stillborn baby. Yesterday, a judge ruled that Foster would get prison time under a law that dates back 162 years.
He has taken the letter of a law that predates the light bulb here. And let's be clear that the 1861 Offense Against the Persons Act stands in opposite of anything that we know now about women's rights and reproductive rights and human rights.
The 19th century law criminalizes all abortion. And even though abortion was legalized in Britain in 1967, that ruling from the 1860s is still on the books and carries with it a potential term of life imprisonment. The judge said that he could see that Carla Foster was racked with guilt, but he said his hands were tied. Mara Clark says this sentence is unnecessarily cruel. Some anti-abortion activists think the ruling is unfair too. They say the blame should lie with the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, known as BPAS.
To be honest, I was disappointed that it's not BPAS that's being held responsible for this. I think they're the ones who really should be facing a sentencing.
Madeleine Page is with the Alliance of Pro-Life Students in London. She says BPAS should not have sent abortion pills to a woman without more information about her pregnancy. In Britain, a person can only take abortion pills at home when they're less than 10 weeks into a pregnancy. After lockdown ended, phone consultations for those wanting access to abortion medication continued. Madeleine Page wants to see that law overturned.
I would like to see us going back to how it was pre-pandemic, so that women are having to go into clinics, they're being scanned, we're accurately obtaining their gestation, where you know, how far along in their pregnancy are they.
And that's not the only change Page wants. Abortion is legal in the UK up to 24 weeks, and Page wants that rolled back too. But several opposition lawmakers said today that criminalising abortion needs to end. Here's Labour MP Stella Creasy speaking to the BBC last night.
And what this prosecution and the other live cases, so we know there are other women right now being investigated, show us is this law isn't really fit for purpose, because abortion is a healthcare issue. It's not a criminal matter.
And Creasy said yesterday's ruling could end up deterring people from seeking urgent healthcare. But a spokesperson for the Prime Minister said this afternoon the UK government has no plans to change Britain's abortion laws or its sentencing guidelines. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
An interesting story out of Uganda. For decades there and across much of Africa, charcoal has been used as a heat source and to cook with. The government in Uganda has banned the commercial production of charcoal, but it has continued, and now vigilantes are stepping in to enforce the ban. They see the results of charcoal producers chopping down more trees and how that's impacting their lives and that of the local environment. Sylvie Namwase has been following all of this. She's a lecturer at the Law School of Makerere University in Kampala. A little background in order here, Sylvie. These vigilantes are operating in northern Uganda, but overall across the country, how important is charcoal as an energy source and what is it used for specifically?
Yes, charcoal is a very, very important and central source of energy in Uganda across all households. It's used for cooking most traditional meals in the country, which take between 1 to 2 hours to prepare. Then it's used also for boiling drinking water, because here in Uganda, the water is not safe for direct consumption from the tap. So typically you'd boil it using charcoal. And charcoal is the most accessible, easily accessible and cheaper source of energy, especially in the urban areas, compared to other sources of energy.
And how does charcoal production in Uganda impact the environment, both locally and globally?
So there is a lot of deforestation that is involved, that is necessary to the charcoal production process. So that in itself is already impacting negatively the environment and affecting and contributing to the climate change crisis that Uganda is experiencing. And Uganda has over the past couple of years lost a considerable percentage of its forest cover, largely due to this deforestation processes for the production of charcoal.
And so the Ugandan government placed a ban on charcoal production. When did that happen? And was it entirely about the deforestation and climate change?
So the charcoal ban was actually pursuant to a presidential directive that was issued about 2 weeks ago. And it was with respect to the northern part of the country, that is the Acholi region and specifically within Gulu. So the sentiment is that the region is continuing to suffer degradation and loss of its biodiversity and its cultural heritage, most importantly, because also the trees that are cut down typically to produce this charcoal are considered among some of those communities to have spiritual significance as well. So it's a really a mixed bag of yet very fundamental and sentimental motivations for this outcry and these public protests by these leaders and arguably vigilante groups that has also to some extent influenced the presidential ban.
So, I mean, these villages are going after charcoal producers who themselves are breaking the law. Ultimately, Sylvie, is what these villages are doing, we're calling them vigilantes, is it a step in the right direction?
From a legal standpoint, taking the law in your own hands can never be a step in the right direction. But I can understand contextually perhaps why they feel they need to step in, because of the perception that actually the authorities that are supposed to stop the charcoal trade and protect the environment perhaps are themselves involved in the charcoal trade and they are protecting those who are exploiting the environment. But ultimately, this is not the right way because it opens up the door for all sorts of cycles of violence.
What about the people who for years have just been trying to earn a living by producing charcoal? What happens to them?
Yes, this is indeed a dilemma because you have to also understand that Uganda has one of the youngest populations in the world and in Africa, and yet there is a high level of unemployment. And charcoal burning and the charcoal trade is also one of the biggest ways in which the youth find ways of making a living. So this charcoal ban actually has so many repercussions that are yet to be explored.
And what about the people who rely on charcoal for energy? I mean, do they have any alternatives?
This is precisely why the charcoal ban through presidential directive itself is problematic because it was just announced suddenly by the head of state without any explanation about alternatives. So we can already see how this will be a problem across the board because it is cheaper than the other alternatives, namely electricity and gas, which are very expensive. They are not regular. We don't have a clear system for the electricity network in the country.
So, Sylvie, as long as there are no clear fuel alternatives to charcoal, what do you think is going to happen to charcoal production long term in Uganda? Where do you see production headed?
Well, in the absence of alternatives, I can't think of any other way than that people will continue to find other means of accessing charcoal, whether through illegal means if necessary. And also you have to note that the ban was issued only in respect to the northern part of the country, in particular Gulu. That simply means that then people will start looking to other parts of the country to fill the gap for charcoal. So the illegality around the presidential directive without alternatives will only fuel illegality in the charcoal trade.
I've been speaking with Sylvie Namwase. She's a lecturer at the Law School of Makerere University in Kampala, Uganda. Thank you so much for your insights on this, Sylvie. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
For the longest time, if you wanted water with some fizz in it, your options here in the U.S. were limited. Club soda or seltzer? Now it's an abundance of choice. Naturally carbonated water, sparkling water imported from boutique springs, flavored seltzer. Sparkling water, though, has been around a long time. In much of the former Soviet Union, there's been a popular brand for more than a century, a fizzy water called Borjomi. But now the war in Ukraine is hurting its bottom line. From the town of Borjomi in the Republic of Georgia, Levi Bridges reports.
Here in the center of Borjomi, there's a spring where the water comes out of a little pipe, and anyone can fill up a bottle of water. Okay, let's taste it. Salty. It tastes a little bit like sulfur and hard-boiled eggs. The stuff you buy at the store is much better.
The bottled version of Borjomi has a softer taste than what bubbles up here. Personally, I like the stuff. It's got more of a bite than those cans of seltzer all your friends are bringing to barbecues these days. Here at the spring, I meet Irina Shevchenka. She's a retired hydrogeologist who sells bottles of pomegranate wine to tourists. She tells me Borjomi has some serious health benefits. If you're bloated or your stomach hurts, Shevchenka says, it'll cure what ails you. Shevchenka tells me Borjomi's mineral springs were discovered by a group of soldiers back in the 19th century. And the legend spread quickly that the spring water has miraculous healing potential. Soon a bottling factory opened in town, and the drink became an essential part of Georgian cuisine.
It's always Borjomi was part of our lives because there was no way you open the fridge and there is no cold Borjomi in there.
Tiko Tuskadze is the author of a Georgian cookbook called Supra. She used to visit Borjomi with her grandmother, but she says, honestly, she didn't like the water as a kid.
My grandmother, religiously, three times a day. You have to have a warm Borjomi coming straight from the fountain. And I was dreading it. I still remember the taste. I was like having a lemon, you know, and my grandmother was always telling me, just correct your face. Never show you hate that.
When she got older, Tuskadze acquired a taste for Borjomi. She says it's such an important part of Georgian cuisine that the way you set the table during feasts is actually organized around bottles of Borjomi and other drinks. The water has great cultural significance well beyond Georgia. The state shipped Borjomi all over the Soviet Union. Even today, you can still find Borjomi at supermarkets from Kiev to Kazakhstan. It's become sort of a cultural mainstay, kind of like Coca-Cola for Americans. But recently, Borjomi has run into hard times because of the war in Ukraine.
Last year, it was not good year, okay? It was bad year for the company.
Levan Bogdavadze is president of the company that owns Borjomi. He says Ukraine was one of its biggest markets, but sales nosedived after the Russian invasion. To make matters worse, a Russian-Israeli oligarch named Mikhail Friedman, who owned a majority stake in the company, was sanctioned by the EU and the UK. So some Baltic countries, like Estonia, stopped doing business with Borjomi.
The problem was to receive the money from abroad. There was some rejection with the transactions.
To solve the problem, Friedman's investment group handed over some of their Borjomi shares to the Georgian government. So the majority of the company would be owned by Georgians, not Russians. Bogdavadze says sanctions aren't a problem anymore. But Tiko Tuskadze, the cookbook author, says she still can't find enough Borjomi anywhere to stock the Georgian restaurants that she runs in London.
It's really upsetting. It's like if somebody goes to pizza place and says, oh, sorry, we're not able to serve you with pizza today.
But the Borjomi factory in Georgia has been through two world wars, and the water is still flowing during this current conflict.
I think I can already smell the water from here.
Yeah, it has a specific smell.
At the edge of town, Borjomi employee Ketevan Kochladze leads me to one of the water pumping stations. A hydrogeologist inside the station opens up a valve in the pipe and pours out some Borjomi into a cup. And I finally figured out one of the key reasons why this water is so popular.
And it looks like there's some bubbles in the water. It has like natural carbonation.
It's natural. It comes from these minerals. So Earth gives this power to the water to be sparkling.
These minerals fortify Borjomi with something that's vital in a culture that, well, might have a tendency to overindulge at times.
It helps headache after when you have alcohol drinks.
A hangover?
Hangover, yeah.
Okay. It's really good for a hangover.
Yeah.
Borjomi's use as a multi-purpose elixir is part of the reason its popularity has endured. A drink that holds an important place on the dinner table, both during and after the party. For The World, Levi Bridges, Borjomi, Georgia.
Remember that story we told you last month about Nigerian chef Hilda Bossi? Those are fans cheering her on as Hilda attempted to break a world record for the longest cooking marathon. The 26-year-old chef began on May 11th and kept cooking through May 15th, serving up over 100 pots of food. Well, we can now remove the word attempt. It is official. Today, Guinness World Records confirmed Chef Hilda Bossi's achievement with a time of 93 hours, 11 minutes. The previous record of 87 hours, 45 minutes was set by Latha Tandon of India in 2019. A few rules Hilda had to follow: only a 5-minute rest break for every continuous hour of activity. A sous chef could help with prep and cleanup, but not the cooking. And two dishes must be underway simultaneously at all times. Minding the rules was worth the effort, as Hilda said last month during her record attempt.
If I'm being honest, like girls that look like me, there's always like a certain kind of perception. People tend to underestimate like what we're capable of.
Hilda Bossi says breaking the record not only shines a light on Nigerian cuisine, but it breaks down barriers for young women across Africa. It is the most forbidden song in Hong Kong, not because it has racy lyrics, but because it urges Hong Kongers in their native Cantonese language to rise up and liberate the territory. Glory to Hong Kong is all about resisting dominance by mainland China. Hong Kong's local government, which takes orders from Beijing, is trying to ban the song, and this week, Hong Kong officials pushed for an injunction to stop Google, Facebook, and Twitter from spreading Glory to Hong Kong online. The World's Patrick Nguyen is following the story. What's the background to this song, Patrick?
The song is anonymously written. It appeared online circa 2019 when Hong Kongers were really aggressively protesting in the streets. I remember covering the protests and watching this song become this anthem of resistance. And now it lives on, even though 4 years later, the authorities won that fight. That fight, of course, is Hong Kong is a Chinese territory that used to have special privileges like freedom of speech, but Beijing teamed up with the Hong Kong government to impose a hardline security law that was widely opposed. The song is all about pushing back against that and preserving Hong Kong's identity and its freedoms.
How popular is this song with Hong Kongers, really?
It's really popular. I would say it's universally known among the Hong Kongers who oppose mainland Chinese domination of the territory, which is a lot of people. This week it shot to the top of the iTunes charts in Hong Kong. So everybody in Hong Kong knows it, whether they like it or not. And a lot of people like it.
Yeah, I was actually finding it on iTunes. And I'm wondering about this whole exercise of making a song disappear. I mean, isn't it just another game of whack-a-mole? It's going to be hard. So how successful has the Hong Kong government been so far at making it disappear?
Well, they're pursuing this injunction to stop the spread. Yesterday, a judge deferred a ruling on that injunction to next month, but the goal would be to try and make it so that, at least in Hong Kong, the song would be unfindable. So that means going after Google and Facebook and Twitter and saying you have to block this song in Hong Kong. What you're actually seeing, Marco, is authorities grappling with a vestige of the old Hong Kong, where using Google and Twitter in an unrestricted way was totally normal and uncontroversial. Obviously, in mainland China, those sites are already restricted or blocked. But in Hong Kong, they're still not blocked for now. And these pesky search engines and social media sites, in the view of officials, are letting in radical thoughts.
Patrick, what is the problem here? Why are Hong Kong officials so concerned about this one particular song?
They take it really seriously. They think it's flat out sedition. The song is not violent or anything. It says, "Break now the dawn, liberate our Hong Kong, the revolution of our times." But the leader of Hong Kong, John Lee, says that is inciting secession. So authorities really, really hate it. And they really hate it when outside organizations confuse it for the official anthem of Hong Kong, which happened late last year at a rugby match in South Korea when the Koreans were playing the visiting team from Hong Kong. So that's the start of the rugby match in a stadium full of people. It seems to have been a mistake, the playing of that song, because when you Google Hong Kong anthem, the protest anthem comes up because there is no official Hong Kong anthem. Hong Kong is in China, so they should have played the anthem of Communist China. Mm. So this song mix-up thing has happened at an international powerlifting competition in Dubai and then at an ice hockey game in Sarajevo. And each time, Hong Kong officials just get more and more angry.
Yeah, the wrong anthem played accidentally on purpose, who knows. At times, Patrick, the Chinese government has been able to get major tech companies to do what the government wants. But what about this case? What do you think is the likelihood that internet social media giants like Facebook and Google will actually agree to quash online access to this song, Glory to Hong Kong?
Google so far is saying that it will not comply. Facebook, or rather Meta, which owns Facebook, is keeping quiet, and so is Twitter. As you know, these companies will talk about free speech, but all of them, to some degree, will censor their content in certain countries. Google has an office in Hong Kong. It's pretty big. It has hundreds of workers, and preserving that office may require Google to do at least some geo-blocking. So that means they'd block the song on search engines and YouTube, but only in Hong Kong. So we will find out in 5 weeks, and that's when the courts in Hong Kong rule on the injunction and start pressuring, perhaps, these big tech companies to comply with the ban.
The World's Patrick Nguyen, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The Golden Globes, that other big Hollywood award ceremony, it made news yesterday. Its parent organization, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, disbanded and sold the rights to the show. Well, here's the backstory to that decision.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the Golden Globe Awards pre-show. I'm Zuri Hall.
The Golden Globes was for 8 decades a Hollywood mainstay, a showcase for the movie industry and a must-see for movie fans, a harbinger of what could come weeks later at the Oscars. For Oscar winners, some 8,000 motion picture industry professionals are involved in making those selections. Fewer than 100 people are the decision makers for Golden Globe honorees. Those would be the members of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, a small group of journalists. They cover the Hollywood beat for publications in 55 foreign countries. They have influence, or had influence. In 2016, Denzel Washington, the star of Glory, explained how the members of the Hollywood Foreign Press were courted by his producer.
He said, they're going to watch the movie, we're going to feed them, you're going to take pictures with everybody, you're going to hold the magazines, take the pictures, and you're going to win the award. I won that year.
Allegations of ethics and financial improprieties dogged the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, or HFPA, and in the months after the killing of George Floyd, the group was scrutinized for its lack of diversity. Tina Fey's opening monologue at the 2021 Golden Globes summed it up.
Inclusivity is important, and there are no black members of the Hollywood Foreign Press. I realize, HFPA, maybe you guys didn't get the memo because your workplace is the back booth of a French McDonald's, but you got to change that.
Soon after, NBC decided to pull the plug.
NBC says it will not air the Golden Globes next year. The move comes after backlash over a report revealing the Hollywood Foreign Press Association didn't have a single black voting member.
This year, the Golden Globes are back on TV with a diversity plan.
I am your host, Gerard Carmichael. And I'll tell you why I'm here. I'm here because I'm black.
But the damage was done. Yesterday, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association was dissolved, and the Golden Globes has a new owner. Yep, it's the point in our show where the orchestra plays us off. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.